one shrunken head. Four, go gay. Make others do your bidding.
How's it going, everyone? This is Pat Loika, and you're listening to Loika Mania, episode number 18. My name, of course, is Pat Loika. And today I'm joined by a very special guest, a good friend of mine who I've met, who I've known for quite a few years now, actually. He is one of the, probably one of the greats in podcasting, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mr. John Suntress. Hi, John.
Pat, it's good to talk to you. You are beyond kind with your praise.
Well, it's well-deserved, sir, because you host the Word Balloon podcast, which is one of my favorite podcasts, and you are probably the best interviewer in comics right now. And I'm not bullshitting with you. That's just how I feel, because I learned a lot of stuff listening to your show about craft from writers and even some artists, and you seem to know how to coax any of your guests into giving some really, really good answers.
Thank you. I say this a lot because I spent a long time in radio doing it poorly, and I'm a big believer in Malcolm Gladwell, who wrote a book called The Tipping Point, but also talked, and I can't remember the specific book, but he talked about how people who are good at something, how long it takes them to get good at it and really be an expert at something. And I'm not claiming to be an expert, but if you follow me, he believes you need 10,000 hours of trying to do something before you really get like decent at it. And whether it's playing the piano or playing a sport, he used Michael Jordan as an example. And he said, you know, Michael had that "for the love of the game" clause in his contract and loved to play all the time. And one of the reasons why was it made him a better player. And it really did take me years of sports talk radio and being nervous and not sure of myself and the questions that I was asking. And it really wasn't until a couple years in that I started finally getting comfortable and allowed a conversation to kind of, you know, materialize. I had my safety net of questions and always something to fall back on, but it's really important to listen. And I think that listening and letting the guest say their piece is the best way to get a great interview.
That's actually very true. I mean, sometimes having a guest on kind of takes you in a different direction from, you know, the conversation goes from one direction to another, and sometimes it just doesn't go the way you planned it, but sometimes it actually works out for the better. You know, I mean, I've listened to a lot of your interviews where you're doing a Q&A session, and then the answer that your guest would give out would just take you to a completely different thing, and it has sometimes some, you know, funny results, and sometimes you just get something very profound in the end too. And that's what makes some good interviews, you know, when people just open up to you.
Yeah, well, and, you know, that's what I'm kind of looking for, is that that familiarity, but also the willingness of the guest to kind of reveal something about themselves, because I am curious about where their creativity comes from, just like the writers and artists that learn from them are. And I want to know where their inspiration comes from. And it's fun to learn that, you know, Jeff Darrow was like a big Western fan, and not only, you know, loved the Western movies, but Western pulps and things. Mm-hmm. And, the film fanatics that Bendis and Fraction and Brubaker are, and Rucka as well. And it's just fun. And I mean, and then, you know, they become more real, and it just, you really do. You understand where their inspirations come from. And I think that just makes them more interesting as storytellers. So it's, you know, it's really, it's all part of the package of finding out who these guys are.
Well, yeah. And to backtrack for a little bit, you know, you mentioned you started out doing sports radio. I mean, when did you decide? I mean, I know you put out your podcast like in 2005 is when you started. What made you decide to go into comics? I mean, how long have you been into comics, for one thing? And then what made you decide to just do the podcast anyway?
Sure. Well, my dad and mom were great. They gave me comics at a very young age and, you know, really had me reading the funnies as a kid to learn how to read. And I think a lot of us kind of share that same story. But I literally remember as a 4-year-old kid getting 12-cent books, you know, that last gasp of the 12 and 15-cent era. And so those were my first comics. And I always wanted to get into radio. I always was even more fascinated by radio than television, just because it seemed to be a place where more longer, in-depth talk was happening. And I kind of had that itch even as a teenager. So I was lucky we had a high school radio station. I studied it in college as well. And spent 15 years in sports talk radio. And around 2005, I was working at the Sporting News Radio Network, and our program director decided that he didn't need me covering boxing. That was my one sport in particular that I had a heavy concentration in and got to cover a lot of fights. And he was kind of bored by boxing, and he felt that boxing wasn't as interesting as it used to be. So he kind of stuck me back and had me do more of the other portion of my job, which was producing features for the network, kind of the stuff you would see on ESPN, but in a radio setting. Uh-huh. And so I kind of lost that ability to interview and host that I had previously at other radio stations and at Sporting News. And I just decided I wanted to kind of not lose that, just in case, you know, radio jobs aren't forever and you want to keep your skills sharp. And like I said, I felt like I had reached a point where I was comfortable on the air being an analyst, being a reporter, and also being a host. So I wanted a subject that I could cover that interested me, but also wouldn't be seen as a conflict of interest. So to the radio station or to the network. So I know Jonah Weiland had done a few interviews on comic book resources, and of course Scott Hines in Texas had Fanboy Radio going, and I even called in a few times and would ask creators questions, but I just decided I wanted to do that, and I didn't see very many examples of audio interviews online. Yeah. And so, you know, this was back in 2005, 2004. Right before that, actually, I started in 2004 to do a film documentary about crime fiction in Chicago. I always thought I was a big crime fan, and I loved how Chicago had such an interesting real-world history of crime, but also great fiction writers that came from Chicago or used Chicago as their backdrop for their stories. And this is around when, you know, Azzarello was doing 100 Bullets, was halfway through it or so, and Max Collins was a guy he had just written Road to Perdition a few years back. So I interviewed them because I thought comics would be an interesting inclusion for the documentary. I was going to talk to mystery novelists as well. And I had done about four of these interviews with a friend who shot the video for it, and he kind of flaked out on me. So I was stuck with the interviews and really had nothing to do with them. And I decided to start this website and take the audio from those interviews and kind of make them more into the first couple episodes of Word Balloon. And I started that in May of 2005. I made sure that it was okay with the radio station that I was doing this, and they, you know, of course, shrugged, because I'm like, yeah, anybody mind if I talk to comic book writers and artists? I'm like, why would we care? I'm like, hey, I just, you know, I don't want to get back to you and think that I'm doing anything, you know, that would jeopardize my job. So, no, they were totally fine with it. Next thing I know, I started doing it. And there was a guy that used to be on the Bennis board, Wipeout. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whatever happened to Wipeout. I haven't seen him on the Bennis board in years. But he's the guy who told – I never even learned his real name. But I was just putting these MP3 files up on my website. And he's like, you know, there's this thing called podcasting, and you're pretty much doing it without actually putting it anywhere like Podcast Alley or at iTunes and stuff. And he said, you should post your show over there. So I did. And, you know, once I had amassed a bunch of them, I handed out a bunch of MP3 discs at Wizard Chicago back in 2005 after doing it for a few months. I had about 10 or 12 interviews. And that was a great year because Bendis, Mark Wade, Brubaker, Matt Fraction wasn't there, but
Rucka was there.
I was there that year.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, because you remember, because and Paul Jenkins, because they had that great writers panel where like four of them, Jenkins, Bendis, Rucka, and Brubaker, all talked about, you know, how they approach, you know, writing and stuff. And yeah, so that was a big weekend. So yeah, there you go. You were there for the, you know, one of the big turning points. And back then there were so few shows doing interview comic book podcasts anyway, that I think everyone was kind of excited about the novelty of doing it.
Yeah, and I think you were probably the first one that actually did, you know, the full-on in-depth interview. I mean, just, and I mean, aside from Fanboy Radio anyway,
yeah, right,
you were the first
right.
person to actually do it.
Yeah, because Scott, no, you know, and that's the thing, Scott, and I always give Scott credit that, yes, he was the first one to do it as far as this current generation. But then, you know, there were actually great shows that, you know, really kind of flew by the radar, and it was because of the limitations in that pre-internet world. There was a show called Nuff Said in New York that really did very good in-depth interviews, and one in L.A. in the 80s and 90s called Hour of the Wolf. And they would have comic book writers and artists on for the hour and talk. So there were predecessors, but again, in this new internet world, no, I think Scott was first, but then we all kind of jumped in around that same, you know, first 6 months of 2005.
Oh, yeah. See, I never even heard of those other shows that came before the pre-internet stuff. That's sure. Crazy. And how was that stuff distributed? You know.
Well, you know, it was, you know, they were on public radio stations or they were on college stations, you know. I want to say I know there were a couple guys in Philadelphia that did, you know, cable access shows. And they had video, and they had Neil Gaiman, and, you know, they had all the bigs, Frank Miller and stuff. And, again, it was the novelty that somebody was sticking a camera in their face that, you know, was letting them kind of tell their own story. Because that's the other thing, too, man. I mean, we remember Amazing Heroes, and that was a good place for in-depth interviews. And the comic, what was the one that Jim Salicrup used to edit?
I'm trying to remember.
Comic Experience, Comic... Wasn't that it?
Something like that.
So forgive me, folks, and I'm sure someone out there knows better than us. Mm-hmm. But outside of those print places, there were so very few outlets for these guys to really kind of give their view of what they were writing at the time. And certainly very few audio and video outlets to do that. So that's the great thing about the internet. I think it provides this platform for these guys to talk. And... You know, I mean, there's already so many other shows that do, criticism or do panel shows and stuff. Uh-huh. I was very happy and also wanted to just be able to rely on myself due to the failure of that documentary. I'm like, all right, I got to be able to do something that it's just me doing the interview, and what can I do that is something I can accomplish in a decent amount of time and get it out there. And that's why it's like, you know, I'm going to do this myself. And that's why I don't have a co-host. And it's not really ego or anything like that. It's just that it's more convenient for me to schedule something with the interviewer without having to worry about one co-host or several co-hosts being able to be there for the interview as well.
And
so,
then flaking on you.
What's that?
And then flaking on you.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing, man. Yeah, you know, so that's why I'm like, you know, it's... I like Charlie Rose. I like Terry Gross. They're excellent interviewers on Charlie Rose's show in Fresh Air. You know, it's certainly late night talk used to be a great place for in-depth interviews, the Jack Parr years and the early Johnny Carson years. But that kind of disappeared. And as commercial television and even commercial radio insisted on break after break after break, you don't get the forum that you get on a podcast where we can go uninterrupted for, you know, in the case of a guy like me and Bendis, 3 hours, or Brew Baker a couple hours, and, you know, things like, we'll see how long you and I go tonight.
And I mean, since you started, though, I mean, how many total episodes have you put out since you began?
Well, you know, it's over 350, because the first year I had it on my old RSS feed, mm-hmm. and I have, you know, in September of 2006, about 15 months after I started, I put it up on the current feed, and the current feed has like 316. So I really don't know the official count, because unfortunately I lost a couple early episodes, and I feel bad about that. And I know some guys have been listening for so long, they have them. So they're out there, and I should really kind of beat down the bushes and get more copies of some of the really early stuff. But I've been very pleased, and certainly, you know, some of those are multi-hour interviews. So... You know, I mean, I think the Comic Geek Speak guys are well ahead of me. They've got like 1,000 shows.
Yeah, they're really up there now. I mean, and they put out a show daily. So
That's exactly.
The thing they have going. I mean, there's so many of them too. So
right,
they could just switch around.
No, and that's, hey man, that's awesome. I think that's, and believe me, I would love to get to the point where Word Balloon was a daily, you know, show. I think that would be terrific. You know, I average between 5 and 8 shows a month, depending on the month and stuff. It's especially now that we're heading towards the New York show. I'm sure I'll generate enough tape out there that I'll have tape. There's an acronym. You know what I mean? Digital recording bytes that I'm sure that'll generate a few shows. And no, it's great. I love it. I love doing it.
So you've been doing the interviews for over 5 years now. I know this might be a tough question to answer, but who is your favorite interview? What was your best episode, in your opinion?
You know, I guess the one that always comes to mind, interestingly enough, is the Neil Adams episode. And maybe that's because I grew up loving his art so much that I was so pleased that we had as interesting of a conversation as we did. Because I know Neil is a very particular person, and I don't mean that in any, like, I'm not trying to... mince words or anything, because I think he has a very distinct personality. He's very opinionated, and that's okay. And I think rather than being put off by that, I was fascinated by his answers. So that was a lot of fun. The first Bendis tapes was just hilarious. I mean, that's the thing. I really can't pick one. But what's that?
I remember those.
Oh, my God. I mean, honestly, we had no idea that it would go as long as it did. And really, that first session was like we didn't think it would go 3.5 hours or 4 hours. And at the end, we were just laughing and really slap happy. And that was fun. And it was really nice to discover that, again, another a writer that I really respected, you know, shared a lot of my same interests and that we, you know, kind of were able to find a rapport and become good acquaintances. I wouldn't claim to be friends. There's too many thousands of miles and too many months in between our visits. But Brian always says that we're friends, and I appreciate that. And it's been fun learning his creative process and watching his career develop. I mean, that's without any real judgment. I mean, that's the thing. I'm more interested in watching what happens, and maybe that comes from my background in sports, that I don't want to prejudge, and I try not to prejudge. Every now and then I'll let my own, you know, disappointment in a story maybe come out with a specific writer. But ultimately, I don't really care. And I'm just fascinated to see the ideas they come up with and how they develop them.
Man,
so,
yeah.
So there's a couple.
they're both really good, though.
Yeah,
Neil Adams, he tends to be very polarizing sometimes whenever he speaks up, and I you know, sometimes you have to let go, and some of the stuff that he says, and you should just, you know, remember him for his work, and besides, I mean, whenever he gets out his opinion, though, it's a very, very informed, very smart opinion. So,
well, that's the thing, yeah. I mean, he, you know, he's got some, you know, he certainly has his scientific theories that I don't think it's unreasonable to say are very, you know, much in the minority of most scientific philosophy. But the mere fact that he spent the time trying to come up with it, I just find that interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and then also the other thing, too, is I would say, because I can't pick one. So many of my recurring guests, I think you can tell, I must really like these guys. And again, I just like the way they think. I think they have interesting ideas, or they're very entertaining talkers. And, you know, there's a reason why there are dozens of hours of Jeff Loeb, Greg Rucka, you know, Fraction, Brubaker, and Bendis. I mean, you know, and now John Hickman is starting to get up there, and Jason Aaron is not far behind. And, you know, I mean, that's the thing. These are interesting thinkers. Ethan Van Sciver is another guy like that. And again, a guy with very polarizing opinions. But I find him very interesting to talk to. And I don't agree with a lot of opinions that Ethan necessarily has. But we are able to set aside our differences and still enjoy each other's company. And again, have a very candid discussion. And I appreciate that. I'm not their father confessor. And I'm not Oprah. But they seem to want to open up to me. And I welcome that, because they don't have to show me their hand, and I'm not looking for spoilers, but I am interested in how they think, and I think they appreciate that and want to kind of get their ideas out there.
Yeah, and I remember the Ethan Van Sciver episodes. Yeah, those are actually pretty good too. I mean, I like the, I remember the last full one you did, and not the most recent one, but the one before that, where he kind of opened up on why his books were late, and he was talking about what was going on with his life, and that led to that, and I thought that was very interesting.
Sure, and also,
and very honest, you know, he didn't have to put all that stuff out there about himself, but, you know,
And you're right, and I mean, the other thing too is, you know, I found it interesting because it's fun seeing the changes in styles in comics, and I mean, obviously, every decade has kind of its own distinct personality, and certainly the 90s and, you know, the speculative boom was, you know, fueled by art. And that's obviously, you know, art was dominating the medium. And then, you know, it's interesting that it kind of drove a lot of readers away during that period, and I was one of them. But I came back because I heard, hey, you know, good writers like Kevin Smith are writing Daredevil, and it's good. And I'm like, well, I like Daredevil, and I like Kevin Smith, so deal me in. That's great. And that's when, you know, I discovered Rucka and Bendis and Brubaker and later Fraction. And so it got me excited about writing again. It was very interesting to hear Ethan, as a top artist, say, you know, that he kind of feels like the scale is tipping the other way now and that the art is subservient to the writing. And I thought that was an interesting opinion. And it isn't a singular opinion. I've heard other artists kind of have that same complaint, much as I'm sure writers did in the early 90s. So it's interesting to watch how the pendulum swings.
Yeah, that's the way things are going right now. There's a lot of artists who are, you know, writing their own stuff. I mean, just in the Batman stuff that they announced recently, I mean, David Finch is writing and drawing the new Batman book.
Yep.
And Tony Daniel is writing and drawing the regular Batman book. And I don't know if I haven't seen that going on yet with Marvel because they haven't really announced any notable artists just doing the writing tours for their own book. But I kind of like the fact that DC is letting these artists who are, you know, proven commodities as artists do their thing and
yeah.
see where it goes.
Yeah, and you know, I know Dan Jurgens, you know, got to do a little bit more of that, and it was interesting. I think because he was Canadian. Mm-hmm. And there was some sort of, you know, payment thing that kind of precluded DC from letting him do more of that. But certainly, yeah, being a writer, artist, auteur, for a lack of a better word, mm-hmm. Is not unique in comics. Certainly Charles Schulz did it for years with Peanuts. All the comic strip people managed to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, Milt Caniff was as great of a writer as he was an artist on Terry and the Pirates and Steve Canyon. And I don't know about you, man, but I got to tell you, and I guess I am just a big nostalgia freak, not only for my own time period, but really the stuff years, decades before. I love that stuff. These comic book or comic strip reprint books, I have really gotten into those. And as much as we love our modern era, I'm almost embarrassed to discover the sophistication of characterization and story that you find in those old comic strips. And, you know, I got really pleased talking to some of the pros like Chris Somney, and I were talking about Alex Raymond's work on Rip Kirby from the 50s, a very straight-up detective series. And it's fantastic. It's beautiful, and the stories are really compelling. And another book that I'm waiting for, that a lot of, I think, fans are waiting for, is this Secret Agent X9 collection that's coming out with Archie Goodwin writing and Al Williamson.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Now, that's a writer-artist. But, you know, again, if you go back to some of those classic old guys, you know, Al Capp wrote and drew Little Abner until he was, you know, letting people like Frazetta ghost for him. but you go back to the original Chester Gould, Dick Tracy, or, you know, like I said, the Alex Raymond doing Flash Gordon, or even, like I said, Rip Kirby. You know, there's really good stuff out there, and I've really been thrilled to discover it and read it, and pleased to see how well it holds up.
Yeah, I think IDW is putting that stuff out right now. IDW and Fantagraphics have been putting out some of those collections.
Yep,
and they are really nice. A little expensive, but I'm looking to get into some of that older stuff. But like that, I've been wanting to try the Rip Kirby stuff because I've heard about it. I've been wanting to get into more Private Eye, crime stuff.
Sure. Oh, wow. Well, you know the Steve Canyon, Milton Caniff stuff, Checker, mm-hmm. has been releasing trade paperbacks, and purists are mad because they're reduced from their original comic strip size. But, I mean, again, much like me buying essentials, I just want to read the stories. Mm-hmm. And they're big enough that you can still appreciate the art. They're, you know, I've seen them on Amazon for under $15 a collection. So, you know, if you want to, like, brush up on Steve Canyon, you could do it at a reasonable price. And also eBay, you know, always look out for old collections here and there, and things pop up. I mean, because, you know, there have always been publishers that have kind of taken a stab at bringing back comic strips here and there. Fantagraphics certainly did a lot in the 80s. I mean, Frank Robbins, the great Invaders artist.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, a lot of people are kind of hot and cold on his art. Some people don't like it. They think it's too ugly. But if you go back to his 50s comic strip called Johnny Hazard, it's beautiful. And it's really cool. And I found, you know, in dollar boxes at conventions, very throwaway, oversized magazine-sized Fantagraphic publications of Johnny Hazard that would have a full story in it and stuff, and get it for $5. So the stuff's out there. You just got to root around for it.
Oh, yeah. I'll definitely look for it. Now that we kind of got into it a bit, what are you currently into as far as comics go? I mean, any of the mainstream stuff or?
Sure. Well, I love, you know, I follow Jeff Parker and Gabe Hardman on every project they go to.
Oh,
and,
yeah. I love them.
You know, their first issue taking over Loeb's Hulk was fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
And I think immediately they have, you know, stuck their flags in the mountain, and now that's their book. And I love Gabe on the book. It reminds me of the old early 60s Hulk in a very positive way. You know, of it's that scale of this monster, this giant monster. And it's, you know, Jeff again. I think Jeff is one of the most underrated storytellers out there. And he's one of my favorites, and he's a recurring guest for that same reason. So I like that. You know, I love what Brubaker's doing on Secret Avengers and the Captain America books. I do love all the Bendis Avenger books. I think they're excellent. I always look forward to Vertigo books like Scalped and Sweet Tooth. I think they're fantastic. John Hickman is a guy that I read everything. I'm more of a writer's guy than I am an art guy. And if I am an art guy at all, it is for that classic illustrative style like Gabe Hardman and Michael Lark, you know, Chris Somney. Chris Somney and Roger Langridge on Thor, The Mighty Avenger. Fantastic.
Yeah, that is an amazing book. And
yep.
It really feels like a book that's – it feels like a throwback, but it's so – you know, it's crafted in a certain way, you know. I love it, and Somni is just showing us how it's done as far as the art's
absolutely
concerned.
Oh, no, he's wonderful. You know, Jimmy Palmiotti and Justin Gray for 10 years I think have been an underrated writing team.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
Jonah Hex, month after month, is fantastic. I love what they're doing at Radical with Paul Galassi, Time Bomb, and I think Jimmy, again, I think, you know, I don't know who comes up with the ideas, if it's Jimmy or Justin. I've never talked to Justin. I've only talked to Jimmy. But Jimmy just strikes me as an idea guy that, again, is, you know, they just, people don't think of him right away as a really solid writer. Pete Tomasi's a great writer. I love James Robinson's stuff. I kind of feel like he's got his handcuffs on him when it comes to the Justice League, and it's, you know, it's a frustration that I wish that the more of the Big Five were represented in the Justice League.
Uh-huh.
I don't think that's a book that needs to be in continuity, and I think it should almost be on, only on special occasions should it be in continuity, because it never was back in the past. There was always room for the Big Five, except for the lousy years, which I guess are some of, I know there's some of Jeff Johns and Brad Meltzer's favorite years, your JLA Detroit run. And I think there's a local bias there. You know, maybe if it was JLA Chicago, I'd feel better about Vibe, Vixen, and Gypsy. I don't know.
The JLA Detroit stuff was hilarious, though. I mean, some of that stuff was just ridiculous. With Aquaman as a leader and...
Yeah, but, you know, and I love Aquaman. And I'm so glad that they resurrected him, because I really missed who the real Aquaman was. And so, you know, I got to say, I am more of a DC guy at the end of the day, and I've been mentioning a lot of Marvel product. I really do. I grew up first liking the DC characters, and it was the first couple of years before I started reading Marvel Comics. I certainly saw the Ralph Bashke 67 Spider-Man animated series. That was a big part of my weekday afternoon programs to watch, and the Marvel superhero cartoons. But I didn't start reading Marvel Comics until the Treasury size dollar books coming out. The Fantastic Four collection that had the first Galactus Silver Surfer story. That was like the first Fantastic Four book that I ever read. And it's a great book to start with, because what an epic story.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, those dollar Treasury editions were the first Marvels that I bought as a very little kid. And then I started buying Spider-Man and Cap and... Never the X-Men, though, and I don't know why.
You mentioned many times that you chose the Legion over the X-Men.
Yeah, like, I did.
And the thing, and actually, right now, actually, I've been kind of poking around Legion stuff. I was able to find, because I haven't read anything by Paul Levitz. I know he's doing Legion right now, but I was really interested in picking up Legion Lost, which was by Abnett and Lanning.
Great story.
And Coppell drew it, and I was able to find some of those issues, and I read them, and I'm like, okay, these characters are very interesting.
And, you know, and you need to go back and really get Paul, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but get Paul and Keith Giffen in their prime when they were writing those right before and right after the Crisis, and really actually right before the Crisis, those Superboy and the Legion stories were so good.
I got the trade for the Great Darkness Saga that I haven't read yet, and I keep hearing that is the definitive Legion story. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I am so pleased that now that Paul is back writing again, that Legion of Superheroes book and the stuff he's doing in Adventure, it's like he never went away. And I don't mean that in any retro sense. I mean, I've heard some, younger readers complain that the books are too wordy. All I can say is not for me, and he really has not missed a beat. I wasn't too crazy when he came back to the Justice Society to fill in between when they went from JSA to Justice Society.
Oh, yeah. After Infinite Crisis or something, right?
Exactly. It was after Infinite Crisis. And I was like, well, you know, it just wasn't my – that story just didn't hit me right. But I got to say, since he's come back to the Legion, it's just fantastic. And they have righted the ship for the Legion. I think Abnett and Lanning did an excellent job, and I thought Mark Waid did an excellent job the times they tried to reboot the Legion. But really, when you get right down to it, Superboy has to be part of the Legion. That was always part of the story, and not having them there was this big gaping hole. Just it's like trying to imagine the Avengers without Iron Man. I mean, it is that kind of foundation link that needs to be there. So I'm glad that they finally made a good compromise where Superboy is where he belongs again, back with the Legion.
Yeah, I read the Geoff Johns action run, and when the Legion showed up there, and actually also in the Lightning Saga over
yep.
in Justice League and Justice Society, and I thought that was pretty good. And actually, that got me interested enough in the Legion that, you know, I'll wait for the first Paul Levis trade when it comes out.
Well, yeah,
I wanted to kind of expose myself to the characters a bit more, so I picked up some of the older stuff.
Sure, and Geoff tapped into that like feeling that I think old Legion fans had, and it was just so nice. And this is my greatest compliment I can give to writers, is when I really feel the characters come to life. But you know, they just capture that moment of, I forget who it was, of the Justice League that asked Superman, who are these guys? And he's like, they were my friends, they were the first people I could fly with.
Yeah,
I think Gary Frank had that just very wistful, if it was Gary that was illustrating that chapter, just this great look on Superman's face of like, yeah, these are my friends. And, you know, we all forgot the connection that was there. And that they the good writers of the 60s and 70s and Paul Levitz in the 80s really made that connection. I mean, these were Superman's peers and Superboy's peers, and they really needed to be part of the story because they helped him kind of grow into they, you know, as we all know in Legion mythos, he inspired them, but they in turn taught him how to be a hero. And again, that was just a big part of the story that was missing because of Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was a mistake to kind of cut that out, too. And then, you know, the constant rebooting, I thought, was a major problem. And that kind of made it a little daunting to get into those books because, you know,
sure.
Are they going to reboot these things again? Or
no, I understand.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it was kind of, on the one hand, they had all these Legion fans. I mean, again, you know, Teen Titans gets all the credit it deserves in terms of resurrecting DC when it came out. But Legion was number two and right behind the Titans. And there's a reason why they also went into the Baxter paper format and were given that direct market lift. And went beyond the newsstand because these were the elite books of DC, those two books in particular. And it was, you know, Wolfman and Perez on Titans, and it was Levitz and Giffen on Legion. And they really did kind of bring the company back.
Yeah, that's good stuff, man.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to trying out the new book, especially. I've been hearing a lot about it, and they have some characters there that have shown up before already that I'm familiar with. Like apparently Earthman is in there,
right?
Yeah,
right.
I hear he's awesome in the book. So, and he was such a great. They used him as a villain, of course, last time he appeared. And I thought that was great. So,
well, and it's nice to see Levitz in reverse.
Yeah.
Take something that, you know, the younger generation added to the mythos, and he was able to grab it and say, that's a great idea, let me run with that. And he's finding places to go with Earthman. I thought Earthman was done at the end of Geoff Johns' story. I had no idea that we would immediately have him back in the mix. But that's, again, that's a tribute to Levitz and the kind of writer he is. He's a very, very good writer, and I hope that the book continues, and he is allowed to write Legion as long as he wants, and I hope the audience is there to support it. It's a great book, and also Yidre Sindar, his artist and a great artist as well, is really a wonderful match for him. It's a good looking book, and it's a good story. I think a lot of good things are happening there.
All right. Yeah, I've seen some of his sketches too. Actually, I follow. I think his name is Yildiz Sinner. I'm not sure how you pronounce.
Okay,
it.
But, I'm sure I got it wrong. Yeah. I feel bad. And he's a Turkish guy, and I'm a Greek, so I'm glad that he even likes me. So we've wished each other well via Twitter. And no, he's a great artist. So yeah, I apologize, dude, if you're listening and I screwed up your name. My apologies.
I've seen him post his sketches on Twitter every now and then, and I really like what I've seen so far. So I'm looking forward to that first trade when it comes out, and then if I'm lucky enough, I'll probably jump into the singles.
There you go.
I've been curious about the Legion, and I know you're a big Legion guy, and I know a few other people, like Tom Cavers, is a big Legion guy, too.
Yep. Isn't that awesome? I love that about Tom. Tom and I are like almost 20 years apart in age, and it is so great that we both love the same books. He loves the Bronze Age, and it cracks me up when he, you know, is reading some of these books for the first time, and I'm like, I remember that book. I bought that book when it was 20 cents, man. That's awesome. So it's fun.
Yeah, I love Tom. That guy's hilarious, and he. I like the way he reviews the Flash and the Justice League books in his podcast. And
oh yeah,
it's funny. It's same thing. He's not being insulting to anything to what stuff he's reading. He's kind of looking at it in a different way, he gets what they were doing, and
exactly.
He appreciates the charm of those old books,
right? Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing, he knows the age level it was aimed at. He appreciates the goofiness of it, but also respects the. I mean, that's the thing. I always give it up to these guys from the Bronze Age and the Silver Age because, yeah, they were writing to a 10 and 12 year old audience, but they were also providing this. Great pitch of drama and conflict that, you know, really excited people. I mean, I was 9 when I read Jerry Conway's Death of Gwen Stacy story, and, you know, it blew my mind. I mean, it was so, I'm like, you know, I mean, I wasn't even 10 years old, and this character was dying, and it didn't scar me in any way. It excited me in terms of, wow, a hero can fail? That's a really interesting idea. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, good. It did what good literature is supposed to do. And, I mean, that's pretty impressive to be able to do that in, you know, a short story that, you know, is, you know, a funny book with pictures that, you know, again, you know, 20 years earlier was much more simplified and dumbed down even more. But I really think these guys, you know, they did. They stretched with what they were given to work with and really made young readers think. And I think that's neat.
Yeah, and as far as I mean, we were going through some of the mainstream stuff. We've been digging. How about
sure.
Some of the indie stuff you've been checking out?
Well, let me see. I read Kirkman. I read The Walking Dead.
That book. Like, did you read this week's issue?
No, you know, I'm a trade waiter. I have to admit, I am a trade waiter. So yeah,
couldn't wait, man. I have to read them every month when they come out. It's gotten to that point. I started out buying the trades, and then I just decided, man, I can't wait any longer. I'm gonna have to buy this and just catch up. I can't help it.
Now, oh no, I understand.
Yeah, it's gotten to that point with Walking Dead, and I can't wait for that show to start too, because I think they're gonna nail it.
Oh yeah, I think you're right. I think they've got great people behind it, and I think it's pretty exciting. You know, I'm thrilled for Robert, but I hope AMC. Well, first of all, I hope the people flock to it the way First Blood got its, or True Blood got its juice on HBO. So I hope they get that kind of, you know, excitement going for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's getting so much good buzz, they actually greenlit a second season before even premiering. So that's true.
That
says a lot.
That's true. Well, you know, in AMC, to their credit, I mean, look at Mad Men, look at I love Rubicon. I think that's a great spy show.
I am behind on that, actually. I only saw the pilot, and I want to catch up on it eventually.
The reason, you know, the fact that it was based on kind of 3 Days of the Condor is what got me excited about it, and I have been following it. And it reminds me of the good British kind of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy kind of miniseries that England did back in the 80s, even stuff like the Sandbaggers back in the 70s. It has that kind of bureaucratic espionage feel to it that I think is as interesting as a spy in the field on a mission where he might get shot at any second. You know, the conspiracy stuff works well in the spy world. So, and by the way, obviously that's what lends some of my independent reading as well. You know, I gotta admit, there's not a ton of current indie books that I'm reaching for on a month-by-month basis. I look for crime. I look for sci-fi. I look for war. Those are the genres that interest me right now. Fear Agent, certainly. Rick Remender is a great story, and I'm sorry to see it wrap up, but that's been a joy, you know, from start to finish. And you know, I'm warming up to Nick Spencer, who I know is a very talented writer. I'm kind of a lot of books are aimed at teenagers, and I guess this is where I am an old man, and I'm just like, you know, I don't have to worry about teenage love anymore. That's okay. It just doesn't interest me. And like I've read the first two issues of Morning Glories, and I think that's a fun, interesting, you know, idea. But it hasn't grabbed me, and I am almost more – I hate to admit it, but I'm more excited about the fact that Nick's going to be writing Jimmy Olsen and the Thunder Agents.
His Jimmy Olsen was fantastic. Yes. They were giving it out as a free comic on the DC iPhone app.
Yes.
And I got it, and I read it, and I'm like, wow, this is really good. I mean, He really nails Jimmy. He gets Jimmy for one thing, and then there's a lot of stuff that they kind of refer to about Jimmy, about how he used to be or how he was, you know, he was an adventure character, you know, for a time. And
absolutely,
and they kind of make reference to the fact that he really hasn't done anything lately. So it looks like they're going to build to something, you know, similar to what they were doing back when they were doing the Superman's Pal series. And,
right.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to seeing what he does.
Well, that's – and again, this is something that Cater's discovered, and he and I laughed about because I loved it and read it when it was first coming out. In the 70s, after all those titles folded into the Superman family monthly, there was always a Jimmy feature, and he had become known as Mr. Action. Yeah. And he was – you know, he was beyond – he was still a younger reporter, but kind of in the same way that they allowed Nightwing to age, they aged Jimmy a little bit, and they kind of put him in his mid-20s. And it was, you know, it was really the adult adventures of Jimmy Olsen, and he was an investigative reporter. And he was, you know, guns were blazing and him, you know, hiding out and getting into trouble and getting himself out of trouble. And it was really fun. And it wasn't, you know, they made an allusion to it in Countdown. He showed up wearing an outfit that looked like Mr. Action, and it was very goofy looking. And it was okay. I mean, you know, it was all done in fun. But that's the thing. I kind of missed the investigative journalist. Same way that I also think that it drives me crazy, and I've brought it up to Gail Simone and Rucka and said, why isn't there a Lois Lane investigative reporter comic book? She is more than up to it as a character, and I really believe that as much as DC tries to ground Wonder Woman, leave Wonder Woman to be the Thor-like goddess character that she is. And if you want an action adventure hero, and you can find it in, or heroine, you can find it in Lois Lane.
I agree. I don't like what I honestly do not like what they're doing with Wonder Woman right now.
I don't either, man.
But yeah, I appreciate the
effort, and Don is one of my favorite artists, Don Kramer, and I appreciate you know, J. Michael Straczynski's pedigree and his attempts, and there are a lot of comic stories that he's written that I've really liked. Can't say that I'm a big fan of the Wonder Woman stuff. Can't say that I'm still with him on Superman. The first two issues haven't wowed me, I got to be honest. And I mean, again, my opinion, and I think he's a great, great writer. I'm just not understanding where he's coming from on either of those characters right now.
Oh, I would rather not talk about what he's doing with those characters because I actually had a couple episodes earlier on in the show where I kind of ranted a bit about what he's doing, and I don't want to get into that anymore. But
I gave
Superman run a couple of issues, and I read a little bit of Wonder Woman. And I just don't care for it. I'm not gonna, you know, I won't delve on it, but yeah.
Oh, we'll celebrate him as a great Babylon 5 writer, which, seriously, Babylon 5, I mean, that's the thing. There's a guy that did 5 years of amazing sci-fi television. He's got nothing to prove. And that Changeling was an awesome movie. And I liked most of his Spider-Man stories. I love what he did with Thor. And I love the 12, and you know, I loved Midnight Nation, and I loved, thing, there's so much.
Midnight Nation was a fantastic book, and Thor, I mean, I didn't like the way he ended it, but I thought it was solid for us.
Yeah, Yeah.
And
you love the 12. I hope he finishes it because I love that story.
Apparently he's going to finish it, so I'm pleased to hear that. But
yay.
I just wish the wait wasn't so long. But
yeah, you know, well, that's comics, man. I mean, you know, I'm from the generation that, you know, it took forever for the Rocketeer to finish.
Yeah,
and it was worth the wait.
And back then you didn't know the book was delayed or something. You know, it just came out when it came out. And
God, you'd go to the store every week and be like, "Really, no Rocketeer?" And it's like, "No, I'm sorry, I don't know what to tell you. We're not airing anything." Because yeah, I mean, those pre-internet days, I don't know how. I mean, God, we, you know, if anything, we get too much information, and I think sometimes, again, I think fans are let in behind the curtain a little too much, and they get angry at stuff. And it's like, hey, man, you know, sometimes real life really does screw up a schedule. It just happens.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I don't like about the fact about the how all the information about what everyone's doing is on the internet, because sometimes it just ruins the comic reading experience. You know,
yes.
I mean, you don't get surprised anymore because someone's going to spoil it for you, or
yep.
You see a cover and you already know what's going to happen. You know, the days where you can just walk into a shop and just pick something up and just be shocked by what you see when you get there, they're gone, unfortunately.
Well, it's partially our own fault too for, you know, wanting that fix of comic news every day. I mean, it is a pleasure. Again, interesting how the comic culture has changed from the decades. I mean, again, I grew up an Amazing Heroes fan in the 80s. I certainly read my share of Wizard magazine in the 90s, and now here we are where, you know, really our news comes every day on these websites, and it's a different culture. They need to feed the beast every day. And it's tough to do that. Some guys, and you know, have really adopted very typical journalistic gossip trends. You know, Rich Johnson and stuff like that. I you know, that's cool. I respect what he does. But I'll admit, it's my own fault for scrolling over the Inviso text with my mouse and reading. You know, oh damn it, Batman's gonna die, son of a bitch. You know, it's.
Yeah, so for me, it's gotten to the point where I don't even read the solicits anymore. I just look at the covers, and that's it. Because, you know,
sure.
Sometimes you really have no choice but to see the covers. I stopped reading solicits unless it's for a collected edition, because it's gotten to that point where, you know, I'm denying myself the element of surprise. I mean, the last comic that I read that really surprised me, I didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, for real, was Thunderbolts number one way back in 97. And then that was, you know, that was the most unexpected thing ever to happen when I got to that
sure.
last page.
Oh, absolutely.
And since I really got on the internet and I've been following everything on the internet, it's just become really difficult to find a book and be completely surprised. And sometimes, I mean, some writers and some creators really go out of their way to mislead you, or, you know, because sometimes people just catch on, people are speculating, and of course someone's going to catch on to what's going on. But It's gotten to that point where, okay, I'm not going to read any of this anymore. I mean, sometimes I avoid discussions about actual comics because someone might speculate the right thing, and I'm going to be, you know, when I read it, I'm like, oh, I already knew this was going to happen.
Yeah. But you know, previews does have that important function, and obviously now that Diamond has made the previews catalog into more of a consumer product than a store product or a dealer product, it is tough. Because I do appreciate the struggle that publishers and retailers go through of, well, if you had told us that Cap 25 was going to be Steve Rogers getting assassinated, we would have ordered more copies from you had we known. And the publisher responding back with, yes, but had we told you, there would have been one guy who is more fan than vendor and is going to let that information slip on the internet, and our surprise is going to fail. So it's, again, the advances that we have that have made comics culture that much more interesting are also its toughest enemies because of those kind of problems where, you know, the publisher wants you to be surprised. That's a frustration I have with a lot of critiques I hear, too. Sometimes I think a writer is trying very hard to make a character unlikable in an early chapter because the story is going to turn on the fact that character is acting out of character.
Yeah, and also, you know, it's a good way to kind of start up like a, you know, a redemptive arc. You know, you want to
yes.
You want to build up to that character. You know, especially if it's a title character. It's hard to read a book with a title character that's a complete asshole that you don't want to read. You know, and it's always fun to kind of, you know, you start seeing the little chinks in the armor, and you start building up to the point where you learn to like him. You know, you see that there's more to him than that, and that's always a rewarding read.
So, no, you're right about that. Or even like Demon in a Bottle. Do you think Demon in a Bottle from Iron Man would have worked in an internet environment, or you know, or even or God Born Again? Oh man, you know, you go back to, you know, the early chapters when they're tearing Daredevil down, and you know he's, you know, sleeping in the flop house and everything, and is giving everything up, and it's like, you know, I can imagine, like, I don't want to read this. I want to see Daredevil in his costume kicking ass. This sucks, you know. And it's, you know, you gotta let sometimes you have to let the writer and the artist tell their story and accept the fact that, okay, I don't know where we're going, but I'm intrigued. And again, sometimes they want to antagonize you and make you angry and say, well, that's not how Batman normally acts. What the hell's going on? And that's exactly the response they want from you. They want you confused. They don't want to piss you off and make you walk away, but they do want you kind of like, well, what's going on? And it's a tough trick, man. It's tough to do that every you know, four or five chapters leading to a fifth or sixth chapter to wrap everything up. So it's not easy.
Well, we kind of touched upon the industry for a bit. I mean, what do you think of the stuff that's been going on right now? I mean, unfortunately, a couple of days ago, Wildstorm closed down, and I was really bummed by that news, because I had always there's a time in my life where, you know, I wanted to work for Wildstorm, because, you know, they were the local company, and they were and you know, there's a lot of cool, really creative people there. They come up with a lot of cool, like, I mean, out of all the '90s, you know, Image characters or Image books, I thought the Wildstorm ones had probably the best characters, in my opinion, because they were unique. They all looked cool, and they actually, you know, they actually had some decent personalities and good writing in some of their books back then, when even at a time where people were kind of giving up on what Image was putting out.
And no, you're right about that.
Yeah. And I was really sad. And for some reason, I was really bummed out the whole day when they announced that.
Well, you know, and it's funny, because I didn't have that same love. And again, I was kind of on the outside, so I really kind of came back in 99. Mm-hmm. So I was late to the game for a lot of the regular standby Wildstorm universe, like the Authority, Wildcats, Stormwatch. I quickly read a bunch of trades of some of the good stuff and grew to appreciate them, but their best days were behind them. I mean, by the time I got in, that's when, you know, Miller was being pushed off of the Authority. And so, if anything, by the same token, what did get me excited about Wildstorm was Automatic Kafka, Joe Casey and Ashley Wood. Awesome story. And actually reading Heidi McDonald's retrospective of some of the best moments of Wildstorm made me remember some of this stuff. Again, Jimmy Palmiotti and Justin on 21 Down, great series.
The Resistance also.
Resistance was great. Sleeper was excellent. You know, I mean, Sleeper was really what made me... I like Brubaker's Batman, but it was Sleeper that I'm like, holy shit, who is this guy? And why is... You know, he should write everything. I love... You know, I mean, yeah,
That's the book that got me into his stuff to begin with.
There you go.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, it was that stuff. But, you know, we've been, you know, 5 years removed from that last great moment of Wildstorm. And, you know, the attempted reboot with Grant Morrison writing all that stuff kind of misfired, and it was interesting that all these top line books of Wildstorms were all delayed, and nobody knew when the next issue was going to come out. Meanwhile, these little engines that could, in Stormwatch being done by Christos Gage and Welcome to Tranquility by Gail Simone, those were the exciting books that were coming out from Wildstorm. It just seems, especially in the last 3 years, the creativity. I don't know. I mean, I like Garrison, the Jeff Marriott, Francesco Francavilla combination, that Western that came out from Wildstorm. Mm-hmm. I've enjoyed that. There hasn't been much in the last 3 years, and I do understand the numbers. And also, it stopped being Jim Lee's company the minute DC bought him.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the thing. So, and, you know, guys, good creative editors like Ben Abernathy and that were obviously on the lookout for interesting ideas.
Yeah, and they also had, remember, also they had guys like John Layman and Scott Dunbier.
Yes.
They, and And I always thought that whenever they were reaching a creative peak, they were getting pulled down by, you know, by someone above. Yeah, and that,
yes,
that was most of the most unfortunate thing about it, because remember the mid-2000s when they had like that big, like, I think in the early 2000s, actually, when they had that big Eye of the Storm relaunch where they were all mature readers' books. Like you mentioned, Automatic Kafka, and then they had Wildcats 3.0, and then Sleeper Volume 2. That was literally a golden age for them, because those are some of the most well written books. I mean, I love Fraction's Iron Man, but some of the stuff he's doing right now, they did that in Wildcats 3.0 many years ago, and it was so ahead of its time.
No, you're absolutely right about that, and also Joe Casey's ambition, and really Joe was on twice very early on Word Balloon, and it was because of books like Wildcats 3.0 and Automatic Kafka, because he had some really ambitious ideas about superheroes and corporations. And again, yeah, you're right. This is kind of the area that Fraction is scratching on now. And again, you're right. I think society is catching up to it. But give Joe Casey a lot of credit, because he was exploring those ideas, as you say, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, even 7 years ago. So that was neat. Plus, the look of the books were different. And I remember, you know, I mean, as much as I loved another indie book that I liked from Image, Godland, him and Tom Scioli, is such a beautiful book. A lot of Joe Casey's books, no matter who the artist is that he's paired with, he always makes the covers so distinctive. And that was a big thing with Wildstorm. They looked like magazines. They looked like art magazines more than they did traditional comic books. And I thought that was very ambitious.
Yeah, I mean, again, Wildcats 3.0, just the covers for each issue of that book. I mean, they got Ryan Hughes, who's like a designer, and he did some fantastic covers for that book, and it didn't look like a regular comic book. And you read it, it definitely wasn't like any regular superhero comic book.
And as you pointed out, I mean, Ryan Hughes is who Matt used for that first arc of Iron Man.
Yeah.
You know, that he did when, you know, he started taking Iron Man over.
Yeah.
No, it is that kind of ambitious, and that's why I'm a more of a, as you know, Pat, I'm more of a writer's guy. I mean, you listen to the show. And I've been trying, especially lately, to have more artists on, and I think I'm succeeding. And, you know, as we're speaking, I'm in the middle of a Tony Harris interview. I had Francis Manipal talk about his Flash stuff, and, you know, and again, having Ethan back and stuff. So I think I'm you know, Stuart Immonen was just on from San Diego. We talked a lot about his stuff. So it's, you know, I'm trying, but that's the great thing is, I love where comic book art has gone. There are still great traditional illustrative people, as I mentioned before, like Michael Lark, Gabe Hardman, Chris Somney, and I like a lot of styles. I love Mike Norton's work. I love the cartooniness of guys like Oming as well, and you know, people like that. So I appreciate Jeff Lemire's scratchy style as well. But there are so many other interesting, different styles of art, and the people that Brian Wood ends up working on all of his books are always so interesting. I just think that comic art and writing are at really interesting high points of creativity, and people are challenging the medium in ways that, you know, you had like a John Muth back with J.M. DeMatteis back in the 80s on Moonstone.
Oh, yeah.
Moonshadow. Yeah. Thank you, Moonshadow. What a cutting-edge book of its day. And now there have always been ambitious comics in every decade. Now I just think there are more and more of them all at the same time in a lot of ways that I think when they look back, this millennial age will be looked at very favorably.
Oh yeah, and again, with all that stuff going on, it makes the loss of Wildstorm even, you know, even worse because of all the stuff they pioneered.
I think others have taken up that artistic, you know, height. And again, I just think once DC bought it, I mean, Alan Moore is one of the first guys to know the difference between working with Jim Lee and working for DC again. And I think, again, that's why I appreciate your being bummed out. You're not alone. I know other fans felt the same way. And for me, it was just like, you know, Wildstorm stopped being Wildstorm a while ago.
Oh, yeah. And, it's not like all that stuff is going to go away. You know, those books are still out there. I mean, I've blogged about how people should look for these books that, you know, while they still can. And hopefully the Wildstorm universe is now part of the DC universe anyway. It's one of the 52 alternate, you know, universes.
Well, so, that's right. You know, I mean, that's, but again, that's 50. The thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's the thing. They did. They bought that universe, much as they bought the Charlton universe, and they bought the Quality universe back in the 40s and 50s. You know, Black. You know, I mean, that's the thing. There are characters now that are considered very much part of the DC universe, but you know, the reality is Captain Atom, the Question, Blue Beetle, they all came from Charlton. Blackhawks, Plastic Man, those came from Quality. The Freedom Fighters, the heroes that make up the Freedom Fighters, those were all Quality characters. You know, so. DC is the great, what's the word I'm looking for? The great accumulator.
Yeah, they've collected a lot of little publishers and characters through the years. What do you think of the reorganization they're going through right now, though? I mean, it's kind of, you know, there's talk of layoffs and all that stuff. That's kind of scary for those people. And considering
It absolutely is. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to step on you. It absolutely is. I feel bad for him. And I mean, again, coming from radio, it's a sign of the times. I mean, it's an economic tough time. And this consolidation and redirection going through Time Warner proper is a good thing, but it also kind of creates redundancies that likely aren't necessary anymore. So, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's a very healthy Warner Brothers digital area that it doesn't require DC having its own digital guys. And again, if books aren't selling, they maybe they're, you know, maybe who knows what the philosophy is. I have to say that there is such a glut of product from both DC and Marvel that as much as I am disappointed that Wildstorm is leaving, there is another part of me that feels that these guys really do hog shelf space. And there are so many miniseries and one-shots that are so unnecessary, and I wish instead that they would diversify and give us different titles. I don't know if that's going to happen with this consolidation. Probably not. But again, that's why it's great that there are these other publishers. I mean, Boom, you know, going back to your question about other independent books and stuff, Boom puts out a lot of great product. Radical puts out some interesting books. I love a lot of the Image creators. I'm pleased at what's coming out from these other publishers. And I do think that genres of all kinds are being served in ways that they haven't since the early 70s. And again, it's being done by the other guys, not the big two. And there's nothing wrong with that. The big two have these huge market, you know, licensing properties that they should try and maximize as much money as they can and awareness as they can out of these properties. There's nothing wrong with that. And again, if anything, it leaves more room for the other publishers to explore other ideas and genres.
I agree. So as far as the comic industry goes, I mean we already know they're moving towards the digital side of things.
Yep.
With their iPhone and Android apps and all that stuff. I mean, how soon do you think we're before we finally get to that point where we start getting day and date releases digitally instead of the wait between the print copy and then the digital version.
Well, you know, and again, as we're talking, one of the news stories that came out this week that was buried with all the Wildstorm coverage was that, you know, Walking Dead seems coming out day and date now. And for the same prices, as a digital copy as it is for the printed copy, which is really interesting. It's a tug of war because I think it feeds different needs. I think there are art people that appreciate a piece of art on their wall or a piece of art in their hands as opposed to an image on a screen. And I think that kind of thinking towards art is still going to play a factor in comics. But by the same token, I do think that the availability and the on-demand availability of a digital property is a good thing, and I do think that digital comics will exist and coexist with the magazines. I don't know how long it will take for the full conversion the way it has in music. It's hard to say because I also – one of the interesting things that Alan Moore always points out is that with each generation and the level of communication, ideas and innovation moves faster. And we're seeing that with technology so much in the last – think of where the internet has gone in 15 years. It's incredible. And I think that digital comics are along for the ride. So where it took, you know, music maybe about 10 to 12 years to convert to MP3s and digital, you know, almost exclusively digital formats. Think of all the record stores that have disappeared in our lives.
And
compared to buying music online versus buying it in a store, I don't know. I think it'll be a shorter period of time, but I think it still probably will be more than 5 years. I think so. Maybe closer to 10, but I don't necessarily think that stores are going to go away. Some stores will.
I think the good ones, you know, the good ones will stand out and they will find a way to survive. And then the ones that to be quite honest, are not being run properly to begin with, will finally just go away.
And again, I can't get away from the idea too, especially when products like one of the great things that came out, I'm sure you know, from the San Diego con, that black and white oversized Rocketeer.
Oh yeah, I have it.
You know, I mean, so you know, that's something that a digital copy can't
produce.
Right, yeah, right.
Or like that Wednesday Comics hardcover that came out. I mean, there's always going to be a market for some kind of print version of the books.
Exactly. And I guess – and the people that we have to ask this question of, and they're not old enough to really articulate an answer, but it is that, you know, generation that's in high school and is younger. You know, I've got a 14-year-old nephew that just started high school. And, you know, he's the guy that I look – he's my little, you know, mini focus group. And his 18-year-old brother is the same thing because, you know, they've grown up with the internet. They've grown up online. And it's how they consume reading products. That's my cue in terms of how quickly it's going to take. I'm glad that I'm already here on a digital platform alongside of comic books. And I think that's another reason why I'm kind of pleased where Word Balloon is, because I do think that that is where everything is going eventually anyway. But again, I just think that there is something about art itself that will keep comics a bit more unique than the average book on a Kindle.
Oh yeah, you just can't. And in the end, I mean, you both versions, print and digital versions, have their own, you know, have their own advantages. But in the end, you don't have the. It's nice to turn the page physically and seeing the entire page as it was meant to be seen, as, you know, as the artist had drawn it. So there's
completely agree. Yeah. But also, I got to say, that iPad interface, goddamn, the first time I saw that, I was blown away with how good comics look on an iPad.
I've read some comics for the iPad, and I'm equally impressed. But I'm just...
Yeah.
It's amazing. But at the same time, though, I mean, like I said, being able to actually go... look at the artwork a certain way without looking at that screen, and having the book in front of you, and closing on certain panels, and without having to resize the, you know, what's going on in your screen or whatever. It's something else. And I mean, I believe that there's always going to be room for both versions, and I hope they continue to do, you know, they continue going with both versions. But
no, I agree. But yeah, I mean, we're wired to kind of read this stuff the way that we have since we were little kids.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out the Sunday papers, the funny papers. And it's, you know, I mean, that's the thing. I give Scott McCloud a lot of credit for his understanding comics books and recognizing even then that this was going to change the way that we read sequential storytelling when it does eventually get on the computer screen. And what you just said makes, you know, that's one of the perfect examples of that. I was so worried for the longest time and wasn't even realizing with tablets that we'd have a bigger screen. I was just trying to figure out, well, how are we going to do storytelling when the screen is no bigger than a baseball card when you look at most smartphones? And you know, it really wasn't until the iPad came out that I'm like, oh, okay, now I can see a more traditional, you know, layout if you want it. But then again, I go back to what McCloud said and what you were just saying, too. It does. It changes the way that we read the stories. And it'll be interesting to see how artists react to that and use it to their advantage.
All right. Okay, well, you're right. I mean, I really have nothing else to add. But it's, you know, and you're correct. Anyway, we have gone on a little long, and...
I'm sorry, dude.
This is perfectly fine. This is exactly what I wanted to get out of you. So we're good.
Okay, good deal.
And we're kind of going around to... we're kind of back in the beginning. We were talking about digital, you know, where you started. As far as your podcast goes, so where do you think you're going with the podcast? Who do you have coming up?
Well, I've about to start an Ed Brubaker two-parter,
right.
I understand that Brian Bendis has some big announcements at New York for the New York Con.
Oh yeah.
So we'll certainly have a new Bendis talk in time for that. Jeff Lemire is coming up soon. Nick Spencer is coming up soon. So there's a lot of guys in the hopper, and also especially with Halloween month, I've got some horror-oriented guests coming up that not only are comic book related, but also film and television related. Kirkman will be by before Walking Dead comes on. It's great. I mean, the best part of this time of year is post San Diego. Everyone's excited about the new announcements of their books, and they all want to talk. And that's a great problem for me to have. And it's such a I'm so pleased at the reception that I get from the creative community in comics, and it really is gratifying that they want to come on, and it's literally like, as opposed to I still go out and ask people to come on, but I get almost as many requests from creators themselves saying, hey, I'd really like to talk to my book about my book, do you have time to talk? So that's really nice, and it's all I can say is I'm doing everything I can to keep making Word Balloon bigger and allow me more time to devote so that I can put out more episodes and not only get all the creators who want to talk, but also let the fans listen to all these great guys. Cause there's still dozens of people that I haven't talked to yet that I truly want to.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people that I'd like to hear you talk to, but unfortunately some of them don't really like to do podcasts or something.
Well, yeah, there's that too, yeah. But that's okay. I do have some print, ambitions that I think are a foregone conclusion given the amount of interviews that I've done and the ability and access that I've had. Don't be surprised if you see a Word Balloon book in the months ahead. And some of these guys that haven't been willing to talk on the podcast, I've slowly been saying, okay, fine, would you be willing to do a long interview with me for a book? Mm-hmm. And they seem to be receptive to that idea. So I'm hoping that some of those guys that have said no to the podcast will say yes to a written interview.
That's awesome. I would definitely buy that for, again, reading. I mean, a good interview, whether it's in print or audio. I'm always up for that, especially if they have good guests.
And, cool.
And as far as online, where can people find you online?
Well, wordballoon.com is the home site. Come there, and I post my shows, once or twice a week, depending on my ability to crank them out. But then also, the show is – I've reached a similar agreement with iFanboy to the one I had with Newsarama years ago, and I'm with them now, iFanboy. Every Tuesday you should see a new show there. And it's on iTunes, and I'm trying to get on every platform I can. I have an iPhone app. I don't have a Droid app yet, but we're working on it. And so, it's pretty much any place you can get a podcast, you should be able to find Word Balloon. So just Google search wordballoon.com and you'll find out where we are.
Excellent. And, of course, they can also find you on Twitter at twitter.com/...
Yes, indeed.
/ John Word Balloon.
Yeah, where I engage in irresponsible talk that pisses off my fellow podcasters. But that's okay. I don't mind.
It's a public forum. I know you can take it.
You sound like Dan DeDio. Hey, it's a public forum. It's all right.
I tried to do Dan DeDio a few times. I can barely do it. I can barely do his laugh, his giggle.
Well, the giggle's like Cesar Romero doing the Joker. It's like, where did that come from? Because otherwise, to me, he always sounds like he's a waiter at lunch hour when it's really busy. And, all right, I don't want to screw this up. Okay, you got two hamburgers, no fries, two Diet Colas. All right, what else do we need? I mean, that's essentially what he's like. It's like, that's the cadence that Dan always has. All right, I'm at gunpoint. I don't have a lot of time to talk. I just want to tell you Superboy's great. Everything's fine. And the check's in the mail, okay? So don't harass me anymore. That's Dan. That's my Dan. So I'm working on my Casada. It's totally the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah, he has a certain way of talking to it. It's unmistakable if it's him, even if he changes the tone of his voice. But he talks a certain way. The deal, though, he can't disguise his voice, unfortunately.
No, exactly.
I love that guy, though. That guy really helped make DC very interesting in the last
few
years.
He's hilarious. Yeah. He really – I mean, that's the thing. And I know – it's tough being the boss. Casada has the same problem. All these editors and Chiefs do. We're all Monday morning quarterbacks. We all can run the company better. I truly believe and I almost sound like Dan right now, but I truly believe that when he his heart's in the right place, I really think he's trying to tell entertaining stories. The same goes for Quesada. The same goes for all these guys. That's why when a book sucks, I don't get that upset about it, because I think everybody really is trying their best. And I think that, because they're fans too. They wouldn't be doing this if they weren't fans. Yeah.
And they wouldn't be staying in the job for so long if they didn't care, or they wouldn't be working this hard if they didn't care. So yeah, I have a lot of respect for those guys, and I enjoy seeing them at conventions and doing their thing.
They're funny.
Yeah. Oh yeah, they really
are. Dan works a room, and it's just, again, I mean, he's so excited he can't even keep like track of himself. It's like I've been Art and Franco, the Tiny Titans team, started doing a podcast, and I'm producing it for him. And a lot of times, I just in conversation with them, I'll break into Dan, and it's like, okay, I got this idea. I don't know what the idea is, but I really like it. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, all right, I got Robbie Reed, I got Eclipso, and Ultra the Multi-Alien. I don't know what we're going to do with them, but I really like them all. Like, figure it out, all right? And, you know, it's just exactly, you know, and I get that reaction from Martin Franco, too. They love it, so. They're like, oh, sir, we're going to be all over Dan on New York, man. We're going to bring you around. I said, oh, good, he's going to hate me even more. No, Dan, I got to say, Dan is always, he was the first guy I saw at C2E2 walking into the convention. He was, like, going back to his hotel. And he's like, John, good to see you. I'm like, Dan! He's like, oh, Christ, here we go. All right, fine, I'll see you later. So, no, he's a great sport about that, and I do. I enjoy seeing him.
Oh, yeah. And also, like I mentioned, you can find John at wordballoon.com. Follow him on Twitter at John Wordballoon. And you can also find him on Facebook and pretty much anywhere on the Internet.
And, yeah, you can shut me up, dude. I'm so-
And we like that. We want you talking, John. And as for me, I'm at my usual spots. So go to patlocher.com. You'll find links to my Twitter, my Facebook, and Flickr accounts, and all my other social networking. And
someday we are going to make an action movie, and Pat and I are going to stunt double for each other, because I am convinced that with the right wig for either of us, from a long shot, you know, you're not really sure. It could be me. It could be Pat.
Oh, yeah. I think it's going to happen at a convention one of these years. You know, if I decide to grow my hair or something.
We should. We should, like, come in the same costume and stuff and let people think we're the other
guy. I can just say I'm cosplaying as John Suntress or something. And once again, that's it for us this week, everybody. Thanks for listening. And be sure to pop in a nice iTunes review every now and then, because that'd be really nice. And
it's America's guest, Pat Loika. Everybody loves him.
All right, John. Thanks again for coming.
And thank you, buddy.
I appreciate you being here, man. And good luck with all the stuff you're working on. And I look forward to seeing you in New York in a couple weeks.
My man, always a pleasure when I see you live, and always happy to talk to you, either typing on Twitter or at the Bendis Board or one of our places, or even in this podcast right now. So it's a good time talking to you, my friend.
We'll do this again.
Sounds good.
All right, sir. You take it easy.
Your goatee is growing in front of your big French cafe. You're reading Kierkegaard underneath your very black beret. Smoking filterless camels, it's deep just like the teens. You're drinking some espresso, dropping all the names. Standing outside of a windshield, you're feeling very existential. You dream that you were Whitman, Walter Poet the Bard, but you're really more like Slim, an evil tub of lard. Looking in the mirror, think you see James Dean. Now you turn to Dylan, you could have been him. Feeling so depressed, you're looking so distressed. And all the little girls, you just want to undress. You're uglier than your high school principal. You're just feeling. Out of the college, the debt it couldn't afford. So you went out on the road in a 67 Ford. Then you went to Europe, you felt like Hemingway. You even loved a woman there, but you found out she was gay. Man, you're gonna never get rid of your pimples. You're just feeling very existential. Nothing is nothing. Everyone's quit. I'm gonna tie myself up. Have a little. like the center of Kurt Douglas's dimple. Yeah, you're inside of a Chinese temple. In your mind, mind, so, so simple. Standing outside of Winchester, feeling very existential.